right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've got a packed show today, and I'm really looking forward to jumping into it. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with the director, choreographer, and conceiver, and one of the main actors in this play called, it's an incredible play. It's a play that is just knocking me out. It's called Lysistrata Unbound. When I saw it, I wanted to see it again and again. And I'm really pleased that these folks have come into the studio, and we're going to be talking with them at the end of the show. But opening the show up, I'm really pleased to welcome to the show Howard Bryant. Howard's a senior writer for ESPN.com and ESPN the magazine, and he does regular commentary on sports for NPR's Weekend Edition, Saturday with Scott Simon. And Howard's new book is The Heritage, Black Athletes, A Divided America, and the Politics of Patriotism. And before we jump into this, I just want to let people know I'm really happy that I found this book and that I was able to jump into it and think about it. It really did make me think. And I'm not somebody who actually is really deeply into sports, but what I found in this book actually opened my eyes up a lot. And so, Howard, thank you very much for it.
Oh, my pleasure.
Sure. Okay, that's it, man. We're done. Okay.
It's something that you know, when you do a project, you really don't know what the reaction's going to be. You simply write because you think it's something that's important that needs to be spoken about. I think I always look at books as a three-stage process. The first stage, the book belongs to me, and therefore I write about the things that I think I want to say. Then the second stage is it belongs to the publisher, and the third stage is it belongs to the world, and so it's yours now, and so I'm glad that it meant something to you and that it resonated.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the thing is that it was such an all-encompassing framework for you're talking about sports, but there's so much more just jammed into it. And I wanted to start with this. The prologue, you opened it up, it's Here I Stand from Paul Robeson. That opens your book. Why?
Well, because of a couple of reasons. One, I felt like where we are today is reminiscent of Paul Robeson's time in terms of this culture war that we're in, this questioning of citizenship. Who gets to be a patriot? Who gets to determine someone else's citizenship? And the financial and emotional consequences that come with that. I think that when I think about the heritage as a legacy of African-American athletes, people don't usually remember that Paul Robeson did play in the National Football League, the great Rutgers All-American. And they forget about him, and I refer to him as the charter member of the heritage, even before Jackie Robinson and the rest. And so to me, I felt like there were many, many parallels to his time, to what's happening today, where you have a president of the United States referring to professional athletes and American citizens as SOBs who should have their livelihoods taken away from them for simply disagreeing and voicing their opinions.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to remind people, the name of Howard's book is The Heritage, Black Athletes, A Divided America, and the Politics of Patriotism. Now, what you were saying is it's really important in relation to this because there's a whole way that you describe the book as a book about collision. And I was sort of at first, when I was first starting, I was sort of thinking, what the hell is he talking about? And then as it went on, as I went through it, this idea of this is about collision was really important, I think, in understanding what you're saying there.
Well, no question. I mean, to me, there are several collisions that take place. The first collision is the idea that sports is a place that is not political. Is that sports is a place where we all go to get rid of our problems and we watch our games, and you're a Dodger fan and I'm a Giants fan, or you're a 49ers fan and I'm a Cowboys fan, and then at the end of the day we go our separate ways. But that's really not the case in sports today. Sports is a staging ground for many political attitudes. There, post 9/11 has really changed how sports are packaged, how it's marketed, how sports are sold to the public. And so you've got that collision of attitudes. You've got this post 9/11 selling of patriotism and soldiers and marketing to essentially recruit soldiers, colliding with these African American athletes who have now suddenly reasserted their political beliefs in the wake of all the police confrontations in after Ferguson.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that actually I was really kind of thinking about a lot as you're speaking about this, and as I was reading the book, that the central character of your book, and you mentioned The Heritage, but I don't know if many people actually know what The Heritage actually is. So it'd be good to talk about what it is, but because it's a central character in the book in a lot of ways. So what is it, and why is it so important?
Well, I think it's important because, one, it's not a name that people identify with because it was informal. It was simply a title that hit me because each person that I spoke with about this history of African-American athletes getting involved in politics, they would refer somewhere in that interview, someone would say, that's our heritage. That's the heritage. That is the heritage of our inheritance of being active politically and taking a stand, and that history of taking a stand, where did it come from? It's a lineage, and it's not, and as I wrote in the prologue, it's an informal thing. I don't even think people knew they were saying it, but it was the word that kept coming up when you made that link between Robeson to Robinson to Bill Russell to Kareem and Jim Brown and Tommy Smith and John Carlos and Kurt Flood and now and Muhammad Ali, of course, and now LeBron James and Colin Kaepernick and the people who are making their stand today. So that lineage has an informal nickname, and that's what I decided to call the book. It's not something that was apparent to me as I started writing it, but the more people I spoke with, the more that line began to run through the entire manuscript.
Mm-hmm. Now, the thing is, you know, when you're talking about that, there's another thing that comes in pretty early on in your book, and it's something that I think people don't think of it very much this way, but it's actually something that's very life-defining for many black people. The fact that there's this, and actually maybe for all black people, because this is a question that you've posed a couple times in the book, but it really struck me reading about it and thinking, okay, this is something that's extremely heavy, and that's the valuing of the black body more than the brain of the black person.
No question.
That's really important to dig into, so I'd like to dig into that a lot, actually.
It's not just important, it's the book. And it's not just the book, it's the story of our lives. We were here. We were brought here for our bodies. We were not brought here for our brains in the first place. So it is really the original concept of the African-American participation in this country. And when I think about the premise of this project, one of the arguments that I make in the book is that the black athlete is the most influential, most visible, most lucrative, and wealthiest black employees this country's ever produced, the most important. And the reason is because they're the ones who made it. And there's a distinction between the black athlete and even the black entertainer. Like when I was working on this, people would say to me, and when I was conceptualizing, oh, you're really going to say that Michael Jordan is more important than Prince or Michael Jackson? And I would say yes, 100%. And part of that reason is because when it came to integration, it was the athlete who integrated society. The athlete integrated society before schools, before the military. It was through baseball. And when you think about the major institutions of higher learning, so much of that student body was integrated first through sports. Paul Robeson played at Rutgers. Jackie Robinson played at UCLA. And you start looking at those athletes, the black person in America became visible primarily through sports. And I think there was one other thing, too. Black entertainers were always allowed to entertain the white public, even through segregation. But you needed a civil rights movement. You needed a movement to integrate team sports because of the lineage and the next steps. If you integrated team sports, if blacks and whites could play together, if they could shower together, if they could room together on the road, if they could stay in the same hotels, then why couldn't they live in the same neighborhoods? Why couldn't they go to the same schools? So integrating professional sports was the first step to integrating America because it meant that African Americans and the white community could live together. And that makes the black athlete an incredibly important component, far more than any other black employee to that point.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Howard Bryant. Howard's new book is The Heritage, Black Athletes, A Divided America and the Politics of Patriotism. But there was still this struggle, this assertion by the system in a lot of ways that either through it's there, it's just out there, and that's the way it's going to be, or through more conscious assaults. But this idea that the black body is more important than the brain of the black person.
No question. And that's the key, is that when people look at black athletes today and they say, oh, stick to sports, and they look at LeBron James and say, oh, you make a whole bunch of money, what are you talking about? The reason that their voice is still important is because the black brain hasn't caught up yet. And also, when you start looking at what the goal and the promise was, the promise had been that these black athletes, through education, through going to college, through having, you know, being on those Division I campuses, were going to have, even if their athletic talents didn't work out, they were going to be exposed to that larger world of higher education. And what we're finding out now in 2018 is the exact opposite. The players generally aren't educated. The black football and basketball players are the economic engine of a lot of these colleges and universities. And what are they getting for it? If they don't make that leap, if they don't get that golden ticket to become a great pro player, they're leaving college without an education. And that was not supposed to be the plan. That was not the goal. And so you find these movements today about maybe we should pay the players. And so once again, even the black players who are on the college campus, the higher learning, the place to use your brain, we're still talking about compensating them for their bodies.
Let's talk about what sports has meant for black athletes. And because one of the things when you're talking about this in terms of what, you know, the direction that people go in and what happens and how they get there, one of the things that happened, and again, it's sort of, I grew up in South Philadelphia, and it was, you know, Yeah. Well,
I went to Temple. I was in North Philly.
Oh, okay. There you go. But, you know, I had a friend, and I went to Villanova, and I had a friend who was actually, he was a basketball player, and he was a guy who was Howard Porter. And
oh, of course.
Yeah. And Howard was brought to Villanova because Villanova just went crazy. You know, it was all about the basketball team. And there was one time where they were in the championship playoffs or whatnot, and they won. But Howard, you know, and I'll tell you, I mean, Howard actually came to me because we had become friends. It's just I didn't know that much about sports when I first met him, but then which he thought was kind of like, what are you, crazy? And we got to talking about a lot of things that were going on in the world at the time. And so I was helping him, like, in terms of just getting the grades that he needed to get by, because there was a whole thing, and I think you speak to this in your book as well, there's a whole thing of special classes for basketball players, you know, special classes for mm-hmm. athletes, mm-hmm. and things that will guarantee that actually what they can do is go out and do their, you know, play their game, and then if they don't make it, tough. Good luck. Nice having you around. And, you know, with Howard, I mean, whatever happened to Howard, I'm not sure. We lost contact, and I know that he died a pretty sad death. And it was after, you know, he was playing for Detroit, and actually he had a very bad time. But I kept thinking about this guy that had this great smile, was just really a very warm person and, you know, and a very funny person. But then he just ended up dying from drug overdose, you know, and it was horrible. And I kept thinking about how much is that repeated among all these athletes that are in schools and are hoping that maybe they'll be able to become a professional athlete. It's really that again, that question about what has it meant? What has sports meant on that level? And then we can talk about what it's meant otherwise. But.
Well, I think in one of these terms, I think one of the hardest parts of all of this is this notion that sports is the golden ticket, because we know the visible players. We know what sports did for Michael Jordan. We know what it did for Magic Johnson. We know what it did for LeBron James and Carmelo Anthony and Kobe Bryant and all these players. Those guys are the head of a pin, one half of 1%. What about everybody else? And that's why the educational component is so important. That's why when we talk about colleges, you talk about this failure in terms of what these players know and what they are learning coming out of these universities. And if we are going to conclude that, okay, the player is just there to play basketball anyway, and compensation is the way to go, and then just pay the player, then what you're also saying is that, yes, on the one hand, it's fair, and you should be paying the players, and not that this is a debate on compensation for college athletes, but you're saying that, yes, it's fair to pay them, but you're also saying we're surrendering the educational component of this. And the implications on black athletes and on black kids in general will be devastating. And I think that's one of the parts of the book that I really try to focus on. And this is the reason why it's so important that these players be rounded. This is why they aren't just cattle. They're not there just to score touchdowns or shoot baskets for you, whether it's at the college level or the pro level, that they are the ones who made it. They're the ones that our children look up to. They're the ones they want to be. And there's an expectation. And that's this thing about this heritage. It's not a club necessarily that you want to be a part of, because it does come with a responsibility. No matter how many points you score, we still talk about whether or not Michael Jordan did enough for the community. We still talk about whether Tiger Woods did enough for the community. And we still, when we compare LeBron James to Michael Jordan, one of the things we say about him is that at least he's socially conscious in a way that Michael wasn't. So this component stays with us no matter if the player wants to be part of it or if they don't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, one of the things I was thinking about too, and again, I think it's along the same lines, like you have, again, you have all these people that are actually out there trying to make it, and both because they love the sport, and also that, it's a lot of people thinking, well, this is a way that if I make it, I will make it, and I'll be able to live a life that I would really like to live. And at the same time, you're looking at things like you have this thing where you talk about what happened to Robeson, and then you talk about Jackie Robinson and his role in what happened to Robeson, and then you move on after that. And it's like there's that sort of that conflict between somebody like Jackie Robinson and Robeson and where they were going and and the two different ways they were headed, the two different views they had. And then you move into, coming off of that, you move into very quickly, and this is something we haven't had in a recent past, which we can talk about a little bit later in the discussion, but, you know, you had John Carlos, Tommy Smith, Kareem, and others who were in the middle of ushering in a new generation on the tails of what had just happened off of, you know, between Robeson and Jackie Robinson.
Yes, no question. And I think that that's the, as much as we love to talk about the heritage, as much as I enjoy this part of the book, one of the things about this book that I found even equally compelling, not necessarily more compelling, but equally compelling, was what happened to it. After the early 70s, we saw the price that these guys paid, which is why I said that it's not a club that you want to join. It's a club that history pushes on to you. We saw what the culture did to Paul Robeson, destroyed him. We saw that Jackie Robinson was never offered a job in Major League Baseball for all he did after he retired. He was never offered a job. We saw what happened to Smith and Carlos after they raised the black fist at the 1968 Olympics. You saw what happened to Curt Flood when he stood up against the reserve clause in baseball. These players get destroyed for standing up. The reason why we love Muhammad Ali so much is because he was one of the guys that the country tried to destroy and couldn't do it because of his incredible talent. The fact that he lost 3.5 years of his career and yet still came back to regain that championship, not once but twice, to have done that is the reason why we don't look at Muhammad Ali as a tragic figure, except for obviously his health. But otherwise, he would have been another one of those players whose political courage cost him everything, as we're talking about with someone like Colin Kaepernick right now, who will likely never play professional football in the NFL again. But however, the other part of this that I think is fascinating is, as that period of the early 1970s went away, we didn't see this heritage again until 2012, when Trayvon Martin was killed by George Zimmerman, when the Miami Heat got involved and did the photo with the hoodies with Dwayne Wade and LeBron James and the rest of the team. So part of this book also, in one of the early sections, is what happened to this? The players were making more money. The players were being integrated into the society. They were much more risk-averse. They were far more in line with corporations now. They backed away from all of that, the Ali version of a heritage, and instead became much more corporate figures. And there's a huge price there, too. The message that was being sent was that athletes being involved in social issues wasn't important anymore.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Howard Bryant. Howard's new book is The Heritage, Black Athletes, A Divided America and the Politics of Patriotism. Now, here's a question for you, Howard, because when you were talking about all the stuff with John Carlos, Tommy Smith, Kareem, and many others in a whole new generation, that and it was what happened to them, but it wasn't just sort of like it was bound to happen or it did happen, but it was actually, these guys were actually, I mean, I'm old enough to remember, you know, all of that and to have been around for that. But it's you know, the idea that those people, when they did what they did, it set us on fire in a certain sense. You know, it set us, it opened up doors for us in the society. And there was a radical flavor in the entire society. There was a lot of searching for what was true and what wasn't, and a lot of understanding about how bad things were, but also an effort to change it. And when you had people like John Carlos, Tommy Smith, Kareem, and others, you know, in this generation actually saying, we're not going to sit down and be nice, because you can't sit down and be nice in a world that is so screwed up.
Well, there's no question about that. And I think that goes back to that Martin Luther King Jr. quote of preferring order over justice. And as long as we're civil and as long as we're polite, everything's good. Well, sometimes it doesn't work that way. And most times it doesn't work that way. You have to get involved in a way that gets people's attention and also provides risk or creates risk for yourself. Why are we talking about Colin Kaepernick more than we talk about LeBron James or Derrick Rose or anybody else? Why do we talk about him? Because his gesture of kneeling during the national anthem was the one that got everyone's attention, which is what protest in a lot of ways is supposed to do. It's supposed to do something that allows you to, that makes people take notice. And so, absolutely, there's a risk that's involved. There's a courage that's involved. And it's one of the questions that I talk about later in the book about today, how commodified the players are, how super rich they are today, and whether or not wearing a T-shirt gains you entry into this Paul Robeson, Jackie Robinson, Muhammad Ali pantheon. Do you simply get to join a heritage where those players lost and where the players today don't necessarily have to risk as much? Is it really, are you really doing something by having Nike orchestrate a commercial to show that they're on the good side of things? Are you really risking anything? It's a good question for me.
Mm-hmm. Well, wasn't that part of, like, I mean, even as this thing of when you look at how they shut down, how everything that was developing in the 60s and the early 70s was shut down. And sad to say, but what opened the door to it being shut down was the coming into the game of O.J. Simpson, who opened up the doors for slicker and more consolidated business athletes. Money, money, money became the big thing. And then you had people following along with that, like Michael Jordan and Tiger Woods and other people. And that was something that really sort of changed the whole makeup of sports. And then that carried out through, you know, decades.
Well, no question. Well, in the clubhouse, there's a saying, the smartest guy in the room is the guy with the biggest number of zeros on his paycheck. Everybody follows the leader. And it's been a long time since the leader was a guy who also incorporated social justice and black political concerns and advocacy into his public persona. LeBron James does it. You got to go back to Ali, in my opinion, before you had a guy who was the best of the best actually doing that. Everybody else shied away from it. I'm not black, I'm OJ, and Michael Jordan, Republicans buy shoes too, and Tiger Woods, I'm not black, I'm Kablan Asian. There's a line that runs through the death of this heritage. And then there's another line that runs through its rebirth, which is the best players getting involved and saying, this is important. And in a lot of ways, when that best player gets involved, he provides a shield for some of the lesser players. For example, in the 1980s and early 90s, a player like Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf or Craig Hodges, neither one of those players had the protection of the Charles Barkleys and the Michael Jordans and the Magic Johnsons of the world. So they were exposed, and they were treated very harshly by the National Basketball Association. So you do need those star players. You need them to lead. And when the leaders decide that these concerns aren't important, then you don't have movement. When you find leaders who decide that it is, all of a sudden, now you see players having much more courage. They're much more emboldened to speak.
Well, when you just mentioned about the heritage in relation to all this, and this stuff that was going on for quite a while. It dominated the scene for quite a while, and it pushed the heritage into deep background. What's, you know, and can we get a little bit more on the significance of that? Because it seems like, you know, when people understand what the heritage actually is, and the people taking, you know, people actually, other athletes and people taking responsibility for what's developing in sports and in relation to black people and their position in society, and again, escaping from the idea that it's all about just, you know, you don't have a brain, you just have a body, and that's the, you know, all that's getting pulled together, even as they're putting forward these guys who are actually have made their peace with the system because they were getting a cut of the money.
No question. No, absolutely. And there's no doubt, you know, in my mind that depending on what generation you're from, that correlates to how you've reacted to what's taken place today. If you are of my generation, you remember Muhammad, you remember Ali, you remember what he stood for, you remember who he was, you remember what it meant. If you're not from that generation, if you were born later, if you were born in the late 70s, or if you were born in the 80s or the 90s, the player today getting involved may seem to bother you in a way because the player is disturbing your fun. You don't have a history of players speaking out on issues. You have players counting their money. You have players selling sneakers and selling Gatorade and selling hamburgers and all of those things. That's your history. It's the same thing as we talk about in the Heritage when we get to 9/11 and the patriotism and all of the different symbols and flags and flyovers and police and things that are on the stadium and, you know, these displays that are taking place at the stadium now. If you're of an earlier generation, you remember when that stuff wasn't there. If you were born in the post 9/11 generation, this is all you know. So 100%, there's no question in the 1980s. I had a nice conversation with Al Sharpton about this when I said to him, all of this was going on. You still had police killings and everything else in the 1980s. So much of it took place in New York City. Were any athletes supportive of you? And he said, through all those years, not a single athlete stepped up. Entertainers stepped up. You know, Prince would call and say, hey, I support you. Here's $10,000. I don't need the publicity, so don't put my name on it. Michael Jackson, James Brown, they would step up, but the athletes wanted nothing to do with this. And I understand it in some ways because the players don't want, they are viewed through the lens of fans and predominantly white media and white owners and white coaches. And so they don't want to deal with that risk. But the bottom line is that is a conscious choice. And the price for that to the public, especially to the black public, is to not have that black advocate that you used to have, that you don't have that most visible black employee, most important black employee on your side. They weren't there. And just recently, they're starting to come back, but they're not all the way back yet.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, one of the things that I was thinking about, too, as you're speaking, this idea that, look, and you started to speak to this, and it just sits on me around this because it's like all these things that you're saying, like I was thinking about the way you wrote very movingly and very powerfully about, you know, the way things changed when you were talking about, okay, after 9/11, this all changed. And then suddenly, and we don't have to get into everything that you uncovered around this, but it's actually a lot of this, what happens is that suddenly people are thrown into, with 9/11, they're thrown into this whole, you know, thing where suddenly it's everybody's got wearing, you know, American flag hats and suits and they're, you know, singing the national anthem 20 times a day. And particularly in sports where it becomes, you think about these things in the Colosseum and people are, you know, and the Colosseum being the old Roman Colosseum, thinking.
Well, it becomes a mob mentality.
Yeah.
Ways. And yeah. It gets very frightening. And what it does is it reminds everybody in there not to disagree. And you start to see, and this is in a place where we were supposed to not be political. That's why it's always been upsetting to me when you hear people talk about, oh, I don't want my politics in sports, and all they're doing is talking about players, but they're not talking about the fact that the government is involved in this, that the Department of Defense is essentially paying for these displays of patriotism. And absolutely, and I was in New York in 9/11. I lived there at the time. Well, I'm in New York right now, but I lived there at the time. And I remember very clearly over the next several months and years that these authoritarian symbols became fashion items, became fashion statements. You would see people walking around wearing NYPD hats and CIA hats and FBI baseball caps and NYPD T-shirts. And you would look at all that, and you might think it's harmless. But on the other hand, when we talk about collision, and you start thinking about the police shootings that were taking place and the acquittals that came after that, how can you possibly have a fair trial? How can you hold officers accountable when the public, which is the jury pool, when they're wearing baseball caps from the police like they're a ball club, it has a strong effect on the ability to actually have justice.
Mm-hmm. At the same time, these police murders and all these other things that have happened over the years, actually, when athletes weren't separated from that in terms of what they saw happening, and that was one of the things I thought has been not covered very well or very thoroughly until your book. The fact that the police murders that happened over the last, and let's just say even over the last 8 years, those murders and the rebirth of a politically conscious section of an athletes movement, which I thought is, you know, people don't consider that, you know, even though you see some things where people were different athletes will say something or do something, do it individually or a couple people. But there was actually, you point to the actual beginning of a growing conscious section of athletes in relation to what the hell is happening when all our people are getting killed and nobody's doing nothing about it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what you find there is a reason why the players were getting involved. In the past, they were getting involved over Jim Crow, and they were getting involved over conditions. And here, especially because of the viral nature of some of these killings on video, on social media, you have these events are right front and center. Remember, after Rodney King, people didn't believe it because they didn't believe there was video. And then when they saw the Rodney King video, it was like, oh, but it still didn't really penetrate because that was like, oh, that's a one-shot deal. People didn't want to believe what their eyes were telling them. But now these things happen so frequently, it's hard to ignore. And the players, a lot of athletes were saying to themselves, well, it's hard for us to go back to our communities if we don't address this, which goes back to that notion of the black athlete being the most important black employee. People still look up to these guys. They want you to say something. They want you to be part of the community. It's incredibly important to have seen someone like Carmelo Anthony walking arm in arm with the residents of Baltimore, where he was from, after Freddie Gray was killed. And so it goes back to this, and it's a luxury that white athletes have that black athletes don't have. And people always say, well, where are the white athletes? Well, the white athletes don't get involved because the white athletes have the white brain. They have other groups that speak for them. You've got a huge number of a plurality, shall we say, of other voices. You don't need the athlete to speak up the way African Americans need the athlete to speak up. So it's a responsibility that the players end up having. And it may bother the public, but this is their special responsibility. It's their inheritance. And I remember talking to Dusty Baker about this, and I remember he was saying that, look, whether you like it or not, this is how people judge you. And what's wrong with wanting that responsibility? You should want the responsibility of being looked up to. There's no shame in that.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And on that note, let's just jump into Colin Kaepernick, because he, in a lot of ways, has actually changed dramatically the entire situation. And I think it's, you know, and whatever's happening to him, whatever is going to happen to him, a lot of it has to do with what people actually allow to go down. But he has actually taken a stand that has influenced and changed the thinking of many, many people everywhere. And it's really important that people understand the importance of that, and also understand there's an importance to standing with him.
Well, no question. And I think that the other part of this, too, is that the last section of the book is called The Peacemakers. And it really is about how super rich the players are today. LeBron James's net worth is $450 million. You look at a player like CC Sabathia from the Yankees, he makes $30 million a year. The amount of wealth is staggering. It's absolutely staggering. And with that wealth also comes a ubiquity to the culture. And when people see you as visible as these athletes are, we feel like we own them, and we feel like they're a part of us. And when you look at all of the sort of tentacles of business that these players have, the player is no longer a black advocate the way Jim Brown was, or the way Bill Russell was, or the way Jackie Robinson or Muhammad Ali was, where they were very, very clear that I am an advocate for African Americans, for where we are as a people. Today's black athlete is expected to be a bridge. They're expected to be a bridge between black and white, to have everyone to get along, to essentially be peacemakers. And it's not that difficult to fathom also, because they have so much cultural pull, because they have business relationships with AT&T and Verizon, and they own stock in all of these different companies. And so LeBron James is part of, you know, he's got a movie company, he's got a film company now. Colin Kaepernick is not a peacemaker. Colin Kaepernick has made it very, very clear that what he does for the advocacy of black and brown poor people. That makes him an enemy. That makes him very different from the palatable person who's trying to bring everyone together. And he's been treated as such far more harshly than the other athletes, because he's not a peacemaker. He is creating a direct line to the police. He's not saying, hey, let's go do a ride along, and I know cops have a difficult job. He's like, no, you guys are killing people in the public, and you're not being disciplined for it. as in his words, there are bodies in the streets and people are getting paid leave. Mm-hmm. And so that's very different. It's a very different approach. And if you look at what's taking place here, and you ask me why we began the book with Paul Robeson and Here I Stand, is because the harshness in which Kaepernick has been treated for his stance was very much in the Robeson mold, where the attack on him was financial. We're going to take away your livelihood for your stance, for your position. And that's one of the things that separates Colin Kaepernick from everyone else, even though he was a super rich player, and I'm sure he's still very rich. He was making millions of dollars. He's not poor in a way that Paul Robeson was financially destroyed, in the way that Jackie Robinson was no longer receiving employment from anybody. The bottom line is that Colin Kaepernick took a risk. He risked something for this, and that separates him from everybody else in the game right now. He and Eric Reed from the 49ers.
Mm-hmm. And it also lays a responsibility on everybody else out there that knows about this to stand with him, which is really, it's extremely important. Howard Bryan, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, definitely. I was going to ask you, do you have your book with you?
It's sitting next to me, yes.
Yeah, can you, I just wanted you to read something real quick on page 238, the last paragraph. I just think it leaves us with a pretty important statement.
No, page 238, it's the last page.
Yeah.
It says, "The Heritage was never about sports, but about America making sports, quite specifically the black body in this country, so economically and socially important that the people needed the player to be present for them. This is the inheritance of the black athlete, his coat of arms. And no contract or endorsement deal has yet ever been big enough to make that obligation go away. It is a responsibility the black player will carry until America values the black brain over the black body, and black people, like all the others, rise through education and not touchdowns. Then sports for black people can finally be reduced to what it should have always been in the first place, just a game."
Howard Bryant, thank you very much for all you've done, man.
Thank you.
All right, talk to you again. Bye. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Howard Bryant. Howard is a senior writer for ESPN.com and ESPN the magazine, and he does regular commentary on sports for NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday with Scott Simon. And Howard has a brand new book out called The Heritage, Black Athletes, A Divided America, and the Politics of Patriotism. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned.
Well, you better listen, my sisters and brothers, because if you do, there are voices still calling across the years, and they're all crying across the ocean, and they're crying across the land, and they will till we all come to understand. None of us are free. None of us are free. None of us are free. One of us are chained.
All right, none of us are free. All right, none of us are free. And we got a clip I want you to hear while we're waiting for our next guest, and it's an extremely important clip, and it's a piece from Bob Avakian's film. And let's listen to this now.
And the fact is that in this country, with its whole history of genocide, slavery, and racism, any form of fascism, including one basing itself on Christian supremacy, any urge to restore past greatness cannot help but be bound together with white supremacy. The Republican Party has been moving in a fascist direction since the late 1960s, with further leaps since then to becoming more and more openly fascist. And in running for president in 1968, Richard Nixon adopted what has been called the Southern Strategy, which the Republican Party has followed ever since. This is a direct appeal to white supremacy, to the racism of white people, particularly, though not only, in the southern states, who are enraged that black people are not staying in their place. The Republican Party is not the party of Lincoln, as it sometimes demagogically claims to be. It has become much more the party of the Confederacy. With Ronald Reagan, the Republican Party took another leap on the road of fascism. Reagan very deliberately began his campaign for president in 1980 in Philadelphia, Mississippi, where in 1964, three civil rights workers were kidnapped and brutally murdered by white supremacists. There, in Philadelphia, Mississippi, Reagan proclaimed his support for states' rights, which, particularly in the South, have long been code words for white supremacist lynch mobism. And after George W. Bush took things still further in a fascist direction, including the open use of torture and the active promotion of Christian fundamentalism, the Trump-Pence regime has made the leap into all-out fascism. There is a direct line from the Confederacy to the fascists of today, and a direct connection between their white supremacy, their open disgust and hatred for LGBT people as well as women, their willful rejection of science and the scientific method, their raw America First jingoism and trumpeting of the superiority of Western civilization, and their bellicose wielding of military power, including their expressed willingness and blatant threats to use nuclear weapons to destroy countries. The truth, another terrible truth that must be faced, is that in the context of profound and acute contradictions that are asserting or reasserting themselves in ways that are tearing at the very fabric and deepening cracks in the foundation of this country, at the same time as the American empire is facing serious challenges internationally, fascism is one possible resolution of this on the terms of this system and its ruling class, even as this is a horror for humanity.
All right, welcome back. That was Bob Avakian from the film of the talk, The Trump-Pence Regime Must Go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept the fascist America. A better world is possible. This is the direct line from the Confederacy to the fascists of today. That's the name of that clip. And you can find the entire film. You can either find it at revcom.us or you can go to refusefascism.org and find it there. All right. And you can also go to my website and you'll find it. You'll find links to it. And that's themichaelslateshow.com. All right. I'm really pleased to welcome to the show my next set of guests. And they are the director and lead actor from the play Lysistrata Unbound. Now, this is a play that I recently saw in Los Angeles, and regular listeners to my show know that I sometimes present interviews like this about plays or other events that you can't just go down to your local playhouse or other venue and see. And in the case of Lysistrata Unbound, it's because of the subject matter of the play and the insights that I believe were brought out during this interview. Now, you may have a chance to check this play out for yourselves, as the director says during the interview that this is the second cast of the play, and it may be appearing in other cities. So let's hear my interview with director John Farmanesh Boca and actor Brenda Strong. I'm really pleased to be jumping into this because I've been waiting to do this since last Sunday. I went to see a play. It just knocked me out, all right? And it was an incredible piece of work. And I'm sitting here with John Farmanesh Boca and Brenda Strong. And John is the conceiver, director, and choreographer of the play. And Brenda is... she's Lysistrata, but she's just an amazing actor. So, but I want to jump into the conversation right now. So which one of you would be best to give a capsule idea of what the play is?
I think John.
Well, that's very kind of you, too. You know, this is a, and by the way, resisting fascism is a wonderful jumping off point to talking about this play. This is a play that was written 412 years before Christ was born, and it is a sex farce originally. It was a very popular sex farce, and it had an intriguing subject matter, right, which is all the women would go on a sex strike until the men ended the war. But it was a farce, so what ended up happening is, unfortunately, immediately degraded into penis jokes. And that's how it's lived for many, many years. And then there's been thousands of adaptations from film to stage where they tried to express it in a subtly different way. But weirdly, what it always ended up being is incredibly misogynistic, because there was always this wink of, yeah, but not really. Like, this won't really work, you know, even if we pretend it'll work in art. So I was commissioned by the Getty Villa about 5 years ago to create a piece between myself and actress Olympia Dukakis. We wanted to do a project together, and the Getty Villa was very excited to have us do it. Olympia had pretty much covered the spectrum of great female Greek roles. But the one she'd never done was Lysistrata. And the only way I would do it, because my personal background with my theater company, Not Man Apart Physical Theater Ensemble, we are a very visceral theater company, lots of movement, which you probably saw on Sunday. But it's also very political. I can't direct a play. I can't work on a play unless it tries to move the needle somehow. Because I think all art, especially plays, are a political act. And therefore, it has to have something to do with that. Definitely not soapboxy. It's just this has got to mean something to me. So we said, okay, Lysistrata. It's a fascinating subject, but what if we look at it in a more real way? What if this was actually attempted in this early democracy, the first democracy, which looks nothing like our democracy right now, or does it? Because we're still grappling with the same issues 2,440 years later. We really are. And so Olympia introduced me to Eduardo Machado, who's a prolific Cuban-American playwright. And actually, who knew? But a Cuban was really keyed into to Greek passion. I mean, there's a lot of similarities, actually. And we worked on this play together, and he penned a pretty amazing piece that we named Lysistrata Unbound, right? You know, it really tackles some interesting subjects, just like you were speaking about with Howard Bryant earlier. It's like, who gets to be a citizen? Who gets to speak? And if this happened, what kind of brutal reaction would be had by that culture? And we did a lot of work going through the Getty Villa with docents there and with the PhD doctors. And we found out a lot of really amazing things about Greek culture and the first democracy, and it's all in the play. So some of the more shocking things you saw in the play were actually based on real Greek culture and that first democracy, about what they were allowed and not allowed to do.
I never trusted that regime.
Oh, gosh. Well, I'll tell you, it was the birthplace of our democracy, but it was just far, far from what we
recognize. And look where that's got us.
Well, yeah, because we're still working on the same issues of equality, of who gets to speak and what do you get to speak about. Free speech, but you can't kneel. Free speech, but you can't question the current regime. Free speech, but there's limitations because the people in power don't want to be questioned. They don't want to be stymied in any way from their goals. Brenda can speak a little bit about the tour, because I took this cast, because 5 years ago we did a reading at the Getty Villa and it was received really well. But I have an entirely new cast, and I asked Dr. Shelby Brown over at the Getty to take us on a tour like we did 5 years ago, and Brenda went on that tour, and she can speak to some of the more extraordinary parts of it.
All right, you're on the spot, Brenda.
Well, first of all, the Getty Villa is an incredibly beautiful environment with which to be immersed in ancient culture, especially Greek and Roman culture. So it was not only fascinating, but enriching to be there, and they were very generous with us. But as a cast, we wandered around and looked at a lot of the antiquities that have been collected. And, you know, in art, they would depict these scenes of women in lamentation and men in conversation, because what we came to find out is that women were not educated. They were primarily treated as the vessels for the war, for the sons that would go to war. And Greece was very based in a war culture. In fact, many of the playwrights were soldiers. In fact, all of them, from what I understand. Mm-hmm. And a lot of their plays were about war. And so the women were pretty much depicted as in service to that. And they weren't considered citizens. They were very much kind of to be seen and not heard from. So Lysistrata, with her very strong voice, had nothing left to lose, because she had lost her husband, her father, her brother, and eventually we kind of conceived this idea of, what if she lost her only son? And that becomes the catalyst for her to finally speak out. But a lot of the art was, you know, male on male sexuality, and it was very confusing for most of us, but we learned that that was part of the initiate of the young, you know, prepubescent boy is the brutality of being prepared for war. And so I think John's done an exceptional job of making this an artistic and representational kind of expose of that cultural norm.
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, one thing I wanted to ask you, too, because your character really goes through a transition and in a way where, you know, in the beginning, I mean, you know, it's really heavy and you know, having, you know, writing is it brings that out. But when you're acting it, it's also something where you see this person who is completely broken in a certain sense. She's completely broken, but there's a spark of some kind of resistance. You won't do this to me. You won't remove my humanity. Mm-hmm. And it grows through the thing. And I thought that was so important that went on. I'd like to talk to you just about that kind of, because that's different than what people might expect. Well, if you know anything about the Lysistrata thing, it becomes, yes, there are women withholding sex and it's funny and it's whatever. But this was actually something that was much, much bigger than that and much stronger than that in a sense.
You know, I think this play was based on the idea initially of what happens to someone who's considered ordinary and mundane or not exceptional, and they're faced with extraordinary circumstances of loss. And it's kind of this idea, it was based originally on Cindy Sheehan, who was the original kind of mother activist when she lost her son in the Iraq War, and she stationed herself outside of President Bush's ranch and objected to the war. And I think it's that spark that you speak of, Michael, that's so interesting because we all have it, but it's like what pushes us to wake up? What pushes us to ask the right questions? What pushes us to say no more? I think it's the seed of the Me Too movement. I think it's the seed of the Time's Up movement. It's the seed of speaking out against what we have allowed power in this country and culture and globally to do to not only women but to the planet. It's the call to no. The word no is really important. And I think, you know, I think finding that inner no is something personal for all of us. But Lysistrata's inner no is, no, I'm not going to allow life itself to be trodden upon without standing up against it and say life is more important than gold. Life is more important than money, than ego, than winning. You know, this idea of winning is nothing. And she points it out so beautifully. And I think it just, you know, hopefully when people leave the theater, they walk away thinking and asking more questions and how it relates to their current life than just going, oh, well, that was fun.
They definitely do. Unfortunately, I went to see it by myself.
Oh.
And so I was searching out for people saying, what did you think? But it's actually the point that you're saying. I mean, I think it's really incredible because it's also true that, look, your character, that character, you know, she was different in a whole way. I mean, she actually transcended a lot. And when she did, she brought other people with her, you know, which was really very, very important.
Yeah, the ordinary to the radically inspirational is a story that I think all of us can aspire to, relate to, are interested in, you know, and I think that's why Cindy Sheehan ended up being such a touchstone for Eduardo and I as we were conceiving this, because she was, like Lysistrata in this play, demonstrably part of the institution, right? The institution being the government. She had a son in the war. She was patriotic. She was one of the many nameless, faceless, you know, military moms and wives who did their part and we never hear from them, right? And then she broke when her son was killed in action. She became a national figure. Mm-hmm. And that transcending is what we wanted to express in the play, you know? And a lot of the relationships, like Brenda was bringing up, a lot of the intimate relationships in the First Democracy were between landowners who were citizens, who are the only people considered citizens, and those are the people they had their conversations with. So that in a weird way, they didn't have as much intimacy with their wives, but rather with the men that they could share their thoughts with, because it was inappropriate to share your true thoughts with your wife. Mm-hmm. And so we feel like we've come a long way, but as we did this play, we found out that these are the same exact struggles we are going through today. And it's been an extraordinary journey for us, especially since this play was written in about 2.5 weeks' time.
Okay, and this, and we'll have to talk again. We just ran out of time. All right, folks, I want to thank you very much for the play, for what you've done, for what you continue to do, and keep doing it, all right?
Thanks for having us, Michael.
And we'll talk to you again soon. And that brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank all of my guests today, author Howard Bryant and the director John Farmanesh Boca and actor Brenda Strong from the play Lysistrata Unbound. And I'd like to thank all the people who worked on the show, my assistant producer Henry Carson and my production assistant Jeff Pryor, and each and every one of you for tuning in. I also want to thank my board op for today, Teddy Robinson. And if you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. All right, we're going to go out now with Let's Make History from International Noise Conspiracy. Talk to you again next week.